I think I have memorized the treacherous emails between you and Dr. Nikki. I had to know them because I had to prepare an exam for you. I am cold. Calm. I put us before my own selfish rage, and I write the questions on a yellow legal pad that I bought at the deli on the way to the shop. I am ready, and I carry my heavy messenger bag of computers to the bottom of the stairs and try to calm you down. You are shrieking. You should preserve your energy. Okay, Beck, that's enough. You look like hell, you poor thing. Your hair is a wreck and you've been crying. What are you trying to do to me, Joe? I'm here, it's okay. You look at the computer I set up and you shriek again and clap your hands over your ears. I don't understand, because Pitch Perfect is your favorite, but I fucked up and forgot to hit play. The intro screen has been repeating since you woke up, which appears to have been a long time ago. I hit the mute button. There now. How's that, Beck? Alicious 1027? You blubber and whimper, and you're a mess, but you nod, I think. And I tell you to walk over to the sliding drawer where I deposit two flashcards. You look around. What the fuck is this? The drawer, Beck. I tap the drawer where Mr. Mooney gave me pizza, where I gave Benji club soda. Sometimes people do change, and I want you to pick up the cards. I explain. You need to take the two cards, then we'll begin. One reads yes, and one reads no. Joe, you say, and you're not walking, you're not listening. I point to the drawer in the cage, and you obey, and you plead. Joe, look, I overreacted. Beck, take the cards, I say, and you look at me like I'm crazy. Pick them up. The sooner we get started, the sooner you get fed. You pick them up, and you do love a test. You sit down on the bench, and you face me. I see that you ate some of the chips and drank most of the water. Good girl. This is an oral exam, I begin, and you laugh. I'm rooting for you to succeed, so I look the other way. Each question is true or false, and after each question, you'll have the opportunity to back up your answer. You're kidding, right? I ignore you, and you're blubbering. I can't get mad. If I had to watch and listen to the DVD menu for Pitch Perfect for more than 5 hours, I too would be a mess. I look down at my yellow legal pad and begin. True or false? You're having an affair with your therapist, Nick Angevine. False, you snap. I want you to pass this test, so I press. Again, true or false? You are having an affair with your therapist, Nicholas Angevine. I deliberately left out the word doctor, and you hang your head. False. I sigh. You sure about that? Finally, you open up to me, petal by petal, as spring opens. You pull your hair behind your ear. It's complicated. This isn't Facebook, Beck. Nothing is complicated. It is, or it isn't. You are on your feet, rattling, pulling at your hair, growling, screaming for help, afraid for your life, your poor vocal cords. What a waste. I drop my legal pad. I walk to the cage. I love you, Beck. The last thing in the world I want to do is kill you. Then let me out. Soon, I say. And I return to my station and pick up my legal pad. True or false? You are having an affair with Nick Angevine. You groan and kick, but you stab the air with a yes card. Yes! Correct, I say. I make a check mark next to the question. Joe, you say, and you're on your feet again, then falling to your knees like an orphan. You beg, you supplicate. Please don't lose it over Dr. Nikki. It was a mistake, okay? I was crazy, and it's over. I mean, we slept together once, Joe. It was nothing. One stupid night. It wasn't one stupid night. And it's time to move on. Next question, I announce, and this is hard, Beck. This is hard for me. True or false? Joe Goldberg has a lot going for him. You guffaw, and you answer, sure and fast. True, are you kidding? You have a ton going for you. I'm always telling you how smart you are, how much smarter you are than everyone I know. You're amazing, and you're funny and smart and real. I was afraid you'd say something like that. I reach into my messenger bag for the MacBook asshole. You see it and you growl. You kick and stomp and pound your fists. You're acting like a 5-year-old, and I wait for the tantrum to end. I know you love me, and I know you didn't mean these things, but we can't move forward without full disclosure. You're the one who went into my wall. I had no choice but to go into yours. I read an email you sent yesterday to Nikki from Beckalicious 1027. Nikki, honey, I'm trying to end things with Joe, but he has so little going for him, and I'm definitely the best thing that ever happened to him, and it's hard. And honestly, Nikki, sometimes in the middle of the night, I wake up and I think I don't want to be a stepmother. Oh, can you bring back the things they carried? Thanks. I close the MacBook, asshole. I don't show you any emotion. As the test administrator, I must maintain my professional emotional distance. There's a dense quiet. It feels like the rare books are listening to us, breathing, waiting. Okay, you say, and we are in a new place. I am a shit, Joe. Textbook damaged goods. And you always look at me like I'm so amazing, and I don't know why you do that, because I'm not. And I was gonna get your book back, I was. I want to kiss you and tell you I love you and hold you, but I don't. I speak. True or false? You don't want to be with Nikki anymore. True, Joe. And you sit down in the chair and spread your legs and hang your head in between. You lift your head. 100%, totally, finally, true. I open the MacBook, asshole, and take a deep breath. We're moving on to reading comprehension. I'm going to read you something that Nikki wrote to you, and then you're going to tell me what it means. You stare at me. You say nothing. I take your silence as understanding, and I cough. And I read aloud from Nikki's email to you. Is that what you think, Beck? Well, I think I just told my wife about you. It's a little late for you to say that you're reluctant to be a stepmother. This isn't a game, Beck. This is life. I'm coming over. I have nowhere to go. She wants me out, Beck. All this is happening, and you ask me about a book. I close the MacBook, asshole. You have 2 minutes to tell me what this letter means to you. I want to tell you the answer bad, but I can't. I start the stopwatch on my phone. The answer is so obvious, Beck. You're supposed to tell me you want to report Nikki to the authorities so they take away his license. You are supposed to tell me that you want his wife to kick him out and that you want him to die homeless, alone with a suitcase of scratched records and nowhere to play them. And then you are supposed to realize that you don't really want that to happen. You should realize by now that you feel nothing for him. You should know that all you want is me. But 59 seconds of your allotted time have passed by and you haven't said a word. You clap your hands. All right, Joe. The jig is up, you say, too sing-songy. I feel hard for a married guy. I'm a horrible person. I'm not gonna sit here and blame my parents or whatever because I'm 24 years old. A lot of girls have shitty dads. There's no excuse. You gave the wrong answer. Nikki really did a number on you, and it's physically and emotionally exhausting to climb your way out of a trap he set for you. A pig in his rig. You are trying, I see that. I open the MacBook, asshole, and announce. Next question. Reading comprehension of the last exchange between you and Nikki. You wrote, I'm so sorry. Nikki, I really believe that I will never love anyone the way I love you. You leap up. You object. Joe, stop! Please! I raise a hand. Stop. I read what you wrote. I get wet just thinking about you, and that's never happened for me. You interject aloud. I've said that to every guy ever, Joe. That's what guys like to hear. You can't think that's the truth. I lose focus and I react. Well, you never said that to me. Because you're different, you say. Different, hot. You wouldn't buy into my bullshit. You are charming, but I have a test to administer. Besides, you don't want to get by on your good looks, your sexy cadence. I look down at the MacBook, asshole, and continue reading your letter to Nikki. I feel like you love your wife more than you know. I feel like I might love Joe. You interrupt again. I do love you, Joe. I do. I ignore you. It is still my turn to speak. Now I'll read Nikki's response. You want to know how I feel, Beck? I feel like you're a selfish fucking cunt. Good luck to you, Beck. You're gonna need it, seeing that you haven't any morals. I close the MacBook, asshole, and return it to my messenger bag. I pick up my yellow pad. You have 3 minutes to convey the meaning of your last communication with Nikki. I give you extra time because you're a good listener and you've been through hell. Nicky should fry for what he did to you. And I failed you when I let him go. He abused you in that sacred safe haven of beige pillows, classic rock, and bullshit. I feel sorry for you, Beck. It's no surprise that you were so demented that you lied and told me your place was being exterminated. You needed to get away from your MacBook asshole and the asshole that gave you the MacBook asshole. Of course you were climbing into the walls in my home, literally, you poor thing. You were still thinking, pacing, and I am praying. I want you to give the correct answer. I want you to tell me that you don't recognize your voice in those emails. I want you to tell me that after less than 8 hours in the cage, you feel born again. I want you to say that you never got wet upon seeing that hunchbacked megalomaniac and tell me you love me and beg for my forgiveness. All I want to do is forgive you. It's been 34 seconds and 2 minutes since I started the stopwatch and you look up at me and answer. The funny thing is, the first time I ever went to see Nicky, he wanted to know what was wrong with me. He was like, well, Beck, let's figure out what the fuck is wrong with you. You laugh lightly, and Nicky used the same line on me, bastard. You go on, and I told him that I felt like my head was a house. He didn't get it, but I said that my head is like a house, and there's this mouse in there, and that's why I'm so anxious all the time. You came up with that, and he is a thief. Low. Oh, I say, and I should have killed Nicky the first day I walked into his office. He didn't get it until I told him that the only thing that made me forget about the mouse was hooking up. I look at the Pitch Perfect menu on mute. You are nothing like Becca. Anyway, you say, and you continue to break my heart. I told him that I love to be wanted. I told him I love new things. And I told you that too, Joe. I thought you meant crap from IKEA, I say, and you look away. You try to explain yourself, and you talk about your problems like you're talking about a movie you watched in the middle of the night. You are clinical, detached, and you've been this way for a while, long before we met. You call yourself a stalker. You say that you've pictured the same wedding, the song is My Sweet Lord, with a million different guys, including you, Joe. So you did want to marry me, I say. You are my love, my sweet lord. You growl. You don't get it, Joe. I'm not like that. I think you are wrong, and you say that therapy is a joke. You continue. You can't get a mouse out of a house. Not unless you blow up the fucking house. You're exhausted and hungry and incoherent, and I slide the legal pad into my messenger bag and put 2 cherry pie Lara bars in the drawer for you. You do love to talk about yourself, even in a cage. I play Pitch Perfect, and I walk up the stairs and ignore your calls for me to stay. I can't stay. I have to prepare the second segment of the test. I hustle over to Popular Fiction and pick up 2 copies of The Da Vinci Code. I jog down the stairs and find you tearing into a Lara bar with your eyes glued to the treble makers making music with their mouths. I did good. I pull the drawer out and toss a Da Vinci Code inside. Are you kidding? You say, your mouth gorging with cherry pie woman food. I point to my copy. I'm gonna read it too. Why? Because it's the only book I can think of that you and I have both never read. We need to share an experience together in order to move forward. You flip through the book, and you have a deep confidence, a sexual prowess, a bullheaded pride, and a soft, hungry magnet that heaves between your legs. You're not afraid of me, of anyone. Men love you, you know it. No man can ever be a mouse in your house because you'll always have someone, a hot clerk in a bookstore, a horny shrink, a closeted rich girl. Someone will always watch over you, and you believe that you are special. In the cage, you feel loved, not trapped. Just like me. Chapter 49. There is a mouse in our house, and his name is Dan Brown, Lord of our Manor, creator of Professor Robert Langdon, and keen, mesmerizing cryptologist Sophie Neveu. We are hooked almost immediately, and we travel well together. We go to the Louvre, and we follow the clues, and you lie on your belly, and you kick up and down when something exciting happens, which is often. I'm on my side, on the other side of the cage, just as hooked as you are. We take breaks to talk about the Opus Dei and the Priory of Sion, and we both wish Robert Langdon were real, and I find clips of the film adaptation online for both of us to devour when we need to rest our eyes and our fingers. You have never felt so compelled to read, and I admit the same is true for me. I mean, I love Stephen King books, you say, but that's different because his work is so well crafted. The Shining is fucking literature, you know? I do know. And I remember Benji and his refusal to admit that he loved Dr. Sleep. We read late into the night, and you wake me up the next day by sliding the drawer back and forth and back and forth. Come on, you squeal. I'm dying over here. We start to read, but we need coffee, and I bolt up the stairs and through the shop and down the street. And you aren't just passing the test. You're acing it. There's a long line at Starbucks, but you deserve that salted caramel stuff you drink every so often, and our book club is the best. Is it twisted that I can relate to Silas? You asked me last night. This will sound sick, but when I found out Peach was dead, I was more angry for myself than I was sad for her. She was the best friend in the world because I was the world to her. She was obsessed with me, and I couldn't even remember the exact date of her birthday. You were the church, I say. And she was the Silas, you said. I reminded you of the first conversation we ever had in the bookstore, when you teased me that I was a preacher and I said I was a church. Wow, you said. Wow. I smile at nothing and everything as I walk back to the shop carrying your salted caramel. We are a dream couple. We are what happens after Meg Ryan and Tom Hanks finally kiss. After cancer-free Joe Gordon-Levitt and sweet, shrink-in-training Anna Kendrick eat their pizza in 50-50. We are Winona Ryder and Ethan Hawke after U2 finishes singing All I Want Is You. When I reach the bottom of the stairs, you clap, but you are puzzled. Joe, you say, that tall cup is too tall for the drawer. I know, I say, and I love you for living in here, for not fighting. So how are you going to get that to me? I smile and show you the low wide mug I bought for that specific purpose, and you say it again. Wow. You've said that word more in the past 24 hours than you have in the past 24 weeks, and you call me a genius and ask me to tell you again about how I got Benji to go to the shop. We have our coffee together on opposite sides of the cage, and when I finish telling you the story, you shake your head and here it comes again. Wow. Nah, I say. One thing, though, you say, and you set your coffee on the ground. That last Benji tweet, you said, in Nantucket. And I remember reading that tweet and thinking he must be seriously fucked up because he knows that it's on Nantucket and not in Nantucket. Nice work, Sophie. And I grin. And there is no mourning, and there is no war, because we are united. We are UNICEF. We give. Thanks, Professor. You glimmer and you wink. Break, I say. Perfect, you reply, and we are so good in here, and I play We Are the World. And you laugh and ask why I chose that song, and I tell you about how I feel like we improve upon the world in this basement. And you are serious, and you know what I mean, and you agree. And I have never been this connected to another human being in my life. You know the way my senses work, the way my brain works. You like it in there, in here. The hours fly by. And something in the Da Vinci Code leads us into a conversation about the Dickens Festival. And costumes lead to hats, and I blush, and you realize that I know about the Holden Caulfield hat. You close your Da Vinci Code. You hug your knees the way you do when you are truly, totally sad. That must have been horrible for you, you say. It doesn't look good on him either, I say, and I am as stealthy as Robert Langdon. But you still feel bad. I'm a phony. Beck. No, you're not. You're like this nobleman of the Priory of Sion running around figuring me out, and I'm so inept I can't even properly hide a hunting cap, let alone a disgusting and cheap and shitty fling. Disgusting, cheap, shitty, fling. It is a relief to hear you talk this way, and I smile. You give it your all, Beck. You just have to be more careful about who you give it to. You're right, you say. Nobody is more dedicated, more intense than you, Joe. Except for you, I say, and you smile. You wink. We read. When we are both in it, we are quiet. We get sucked into a book in the same kind of way, and at some point, we both fall asleep. I wake up first, yay, and I let you rest. I go up into the shop and stretch. Ethan has texted me.
Joey, my man, congrats to Beck. Blythe tells me she's getting published in the New Yorker. That's amazing. Let's meet up for a drink next week. On me. Or housewarming. Moving to Blythe's as we speak.
Exclamation point Ethan finally has reason to use exclamation points, and I feel happy for him. I go to fiction A through D and find Great Expectations by Charles Dickens, and I am dizzy. I anticipate our future. The day I tell you about following you to Bridgeport, to the Dickens Festival in Port Jeff, you will say, wow, again. And less than an hour later, my predictions prove accurate. You leaf through Great Expectations. Wow, you say, you really did know what my half-siblings look like. Yep, I say. I bought a beard, you know, just in case. You toss Great Expectations in the drawer. I think you're a genius. I pull the drawer and take Dickens out. You ready? You grin. I thought you'd never ask. We settle into our spots, and it feels like we're holding hands and running off the dock, holding our breath as we jump back into the deep, consuming water that is the Da Vinci Code. These are the happiest moments of my life, looking up at you and waiting for you to feel my eyes as you give me what I want. 243, you? I'm on 251. Well, take a break and let me catch up, you say, and you remark once again that I am both a fast reader and a thorough reader, which is special because most people, men especially, are just one or the other. We cry when Robert and Sophie make it to the chalice. We know what's to come as they cross the landscape and enter the church. You put your hand on the drawer, and I put my hand on the drawer, and the drawer is designed to keep our hands apart, but I feel your pulse, I do. You sniffle. I don't want it to end. This is like the end of the corrections, I say. And the problem with books is that they end. They seduce you. They spread their legs to you and pull you inside. And you go deep and leave your possessions and your ties to the world at the door. And you like it inside, and you don't want for your possessions or your ties. And then the book evaporates. You turn the page and there is nothing. And we are both crying. We are happy for Sophie and Robert, and we are jet-lagged from travel. We journeyed. At times, we were so in the book that you were Sophie, descendant of Christ, and I was Langdon, savior of Sophie, and we are easing back into our bodies, our minds. You yawn and I yawn, and your back cracks. We laugh. You ask me how long it's been. 3 days, almost four. Wow, you say. I know. I say, we should celebrate. How so? I don't know, you lie, you nymph. I could go for some ice cream. The Da Vinci Code is the greatest book in the world, and someday, when we live together, we will have a shelf, brand new, not used. I know you and your new things, and there will be nothing on the shelf except our Da Vinci Codes, nestled together, merged forever. By the supernatural force that is our love. Chapter 50. I run out to buy you ice cream, and I hear Bobby Short singing in my head, I am your prince. And I am on air on the way to the deli and on the way back. I bound down the stairs, can't get to you fast enough with the ice cream you wanted, vanilla. You are simple again. 3 weeks ago, you would have wanted some fucking gelato you read about in the Sunday Styles. I want to tell you about the funny dude in the line of the deli, but when I reach the bottom of the stairs, you are different. You are naked. I am still. Beck. Come over here, you command, low. Bring the ice cream. I do as I am told, and your right hand moves over your collarbone and onto your breast, and you have another demand. Give me my dessert. I tear at the bag and the spoon falls on the floor, but fuck it, and I tear off the lid as well as the plastic lining. The ice cream is soft, and my dick is hard, and I know why Bobby Short felt like a racehorse. I am a racehorse. 1 second, I say. Tick-tock, you say, you purr. I play the song on the computer. You like it. You command. Put it on repeat. I obey, and I return to the drawer, and you kneel before the cage, your nipples hard. You want to know if I can pull the drawer out and make an open window. I can. You tell me to take off my pants. I do. You reach both hands through the new open space where the drawer used to be, and I pick up the ice cream and approach the cage. You touch yourself and your finger emerges wet, glistening, and I know to bring the pint closer. The ice cream is hotter because of our heat, melting. You immerse your other hand in the magnet between your legs, and you don't let go of my eyes. Both of your hands are covered in your juices, and you dip those wet fingers into the melting vanilla. You tease me. You tell me you want my mouth, and I give you my mouth, and your fingers fill my mouth. And your other fingers are touching skillfully, mysteriously, her first rose. My dick. Your hands are the Da Vinci Code, and my body is yours. I suck the life out of your fingers, and you pry them from my mouth. I look down at you, and you are in the vanilla. You dig deep. Your vanilla hand joins your other hand on my hard cock, and I am cool and hot and hard to your soft. Your hands can dance, and they lead me to your mouth, and you swallow me, and I moan, and we are the world, and there is barely room for the three of us, my cock and your hands. I belong in your mouth, and when I open my eyes, you are staring at me, wide, whole. I need you, all of you. You want all of me. You know all my secrets, and your mouth has teeth. You take me out of your mouth and hold me in your hands. You look up at me, pleading. Fuck me. I don't consciously decide to trust you. My body takes over, and I can't unlock the cage fast enough. You rub your hands over your body, and you wait. I jam the key into the lock, and I miss your touch, and I enter your space. You. You do not run away. You run at me. Lust. I lock my hand around your neck and inject my tongue into your mouth, and you take it. You scratch me. I could kill you, and you know it, and your nipples are harder than ever, and your pussy never felt this sweet, this tight, just vanilla. And we could go on like this forever. You orgasm, truly. You're exploding, and it's an exorcism and an exclamation point. You're speaking in tongues, and I own you, and I'm in you, and I loosen my grip and explode, and you own me. You do. Your back arches. Wow. I have taken you places better than the Upper West Side. Superior to Turks and Caicos and Nikki's beige room. I have taken you to France, to the chalice, to the moon, and you cease to move, and a smile rolls over your entire body, and you're a lily pad, sun-stroked and floating, rooted to the floor of the lake, me, dark above you. The cage door is wide open, and I'm half naked, and I'd never be able to catch you if you ran up the stairs. If you grabbed my empty dick and kicked and tried to make a run for it, you would make it. The basement doors are unlocked, so you could, theoretically, escape upstairs. But the front door is locked. You didn't work here long enough to learn where I stashed the key. Still, if you wanted to, you could risk it all to run naked into the shop and scream for help. Someone would help you, and someone would come for me, but none of that is happening. Your body can't tell lies, and your goosebumps tell the truth. You lick your lips and look up at me. You purr. Joe? Wow. Chapter 51. At some point, I stop pretending to be asleep and allow myself to watch you sleep. We live in a new world, and I kiss you and I stretch. I need to wash up, and I walk out of the cage. I don't lock you in. We don't lock doors in this new world. I leave the cage door ajar, and I do the same for the soundproof basement door as well as the vestibule door that opens into the shop. We are free, and I carry the Da Vinci Codes with me, like a kid with a new toy. When I make it upstairs, I am genuinely surprised to find the books are where they were before we started reading. They survived the earthquake of our orgasm, and the closed sign is where it was when we traveled into the Da Vinci Code, and the bathroom is just as it was earlier today, before I fucked you to life. I flip on the switch, and the tiny bathroom fills with halogen light and the loud, shitty fan that you nagged me to replace. Even the fan makes me smile because of you, and I will replace it, Beck. You're right, it's too noisy. And it's so old that it can't possibly serve any function. It's also a safety hazard when I'm in the shop alone because one switch controls the light and the fan. You can't have light without noise, and you can't hear anything above the whir of the fan, and you're right, Beck, it's dangerous. I flush the toilet and turn on the water and look at myself in the mirror. I look good, happy. And I wonder if I should join Facebook so that you can link your profile to mine. I should get on that now before you have to nag me and I add it to the list in my head. I let the water run hot over my hands, and I don't know if I can really join Facebook for you.
I read somewhere that kids now are so dishonest that there's an actual game they play called Truth. You go to someone's wall, such bullshit, the language, and you write, "Truth is, dot, dot, dot," and then reveal something both surprising and true. It's a sad and grotesque thing that you and your friends have become so accustomed to lies that the truth has to be prefaced because it's inherently surprising. A startling departure from the lies that comprise your lives. But you're done with that now. And maybe before you delete your Facebook profile, you'll make one last status update. Truth is, I fucking love the Da Vinci Code. We've got big decisions to make, Beck. Will you move in with me? Will I move in with you? Will we stay in New York? Granted, I have this great job, but I think you'd do well in California. You don't know enough to be around New York writers. And now that we have each other, we can roam. I look at my Da Vinci Code on top of yours. They look good together, Beck. This is right. I pick up the bar of soap and get a good lather going. I'm sad to wash off you and the vanilla ice cream, but then again, I am excited to soil myself anew with your sweat and your cum, your juices and your saliva. The fan is loud and my dick is hard, and I know what I'm gonna do now. I'm gonna wake you up with my mouth. I'm gonna eat you alive. It's a good thing I keep a toothbrush handy. And it's dry, and I smile because the next time I brush my teeth, the brush will be wet because you will have used it. I feel holy and dedicated as Silas while I brush my teeth and dampen my pits and spray the cologne I bought to smell like the bartender. God, I know you. I splash some water in my hair. I would shave, but I miss you too much. I need to eat you, and I need to eat you now. I flick the switch. The lights go out and the fan slows, and I do not open the door. Something is wrong. The silence is cracked by terrible sounds. Feet pounding on the floorboards, your distressed vocal cords. Help! And the front door resisting you as you tug. I grab our books and creep out of the bathroom, and you are still up front and pounding, and it is, fortunately, 4 o'clock in the morning, and there is nobody around to hear you. Whoever called New York the city that never sleeps didn't work at Mooney Rare and Used. I walk to the center of the shop and see you at the front, your crazy hair, crazy limbs, in my mother's Nirvana t-shirt, pulling on the door with both hands, so lost in your mission that you don't hear me coming. I am quiet as a cat. I take soft, meaningful steps and I set our Da Vinci codes on the counter. You do not sense me and you are so close to the glass door that you don't see my reflection. I was right, you couldn't find the key. I wrap my arms around you and you kick. No! Let go of me, you sick fuck! I have a solid grip on you, and it's a shame that you're in a rage, because I could really give it to you right now. But you are an animal. Kick, kick, and a handicapped monster. Why do you waste time flailing your arms, little one? You can't reach me. I carry you down the aisle and drag you onto the floor behind the counter. I slide us to the floor and stretch my legs and hold you on my lap. Even if someone were to pass by, we would go unnoticed, protected as we are by the counter. You fight to get away, but I can hold you for the rest of my life if I have to. As always, your anger eventually cools. Your muscles relax, and you are my new doll. Sad Beck. You don't talk. You just cry. You don't fight me, and there is hope. I kiss your neck. You don't like it. It's not a time for kisses, I understand. This is a lot to take in, a lot of change, and the sun isn't coming up for a while. And I rock you and look at your naked legs on top of mine. This is what love looks like. I know it. You don't try to claw me anymore. We sit in silence for so long that you must be ready to be good. I begin. I test you. So what are we gonna do with you? The correct answer? You should beg for my forgiveness. Admit that you freaked out when you woke up alone. You thought I had abandoned you the way your father abandoned you. The way all the men in your life abandoned you. And then I promise to stay with you forever. And you caress my hands and I forgive you and let you guide my hands to your center, your magnet. I killed for you. I deserve you. I wish I could see your face and you haven't answered, so I rephrase the question. What happens now, Beck? The correct answer? Love. You answer with a voice so flat I almost don't recognize you. I disappear? No. No. Listen to me, Joe, you say as you press your hands into mine in a manner that is entirely devoid of sex, of passion. I don't care about what you did to Benji or Peach. I get it. Benji really did have a drug problem, and Peach really did have issues. She was a liar, Beck. She even made up bullshit about her bladder. I know, you say, and you forgive too easily. I just loved that she loved me. And what do you want now? The correct answer? Me. You sigh. You tell me that you don't want to be a writer. You want to go to Los Angeles and be an actress. And maybe if I don't get any jobs, well, maybe I'll write something for myself, you know? It gets worse. You tell me that you are basically a very lazy girl. I hold you and you elaborate on your flaws. Blythe is right. Half the time my stories really are just diary entries. Half the time I have to search and replace the names in order to turn the pages into fiction. That's how bad I am. Uh-huh, I say, and I am not letting go, and these are the wrong answers. You don't want me, Joe. And I look at your feet, the toes that Peach molested in Little Compton. You think I'm this dreamy writer girl, but I'm not. Nikki has every right to hate me, I fully admit it. I didn't really want him. I just wanted him to leave his wife for me. I wanted to fuck up his kids, and yes, Joe, I do know how sick that sounds. No. You're not sick. You blurt. I saw you at my reading that night in Brooklyn. I knew you followed me. I hold on to you and kiss your head because we really are the same. And we are the house and the mouse, and you know it. You do. I thought so, I say. I hoped so. You squish your toes into my pants. Then you know I'd never turn you in, Joe. I'm the connector in all this. I'm the toxic one. I know this mess is my fault, and I would never go to the police, Joe. You let me out of here, and I'm gone. Forever. I give you another chance. I don't want you to be gone forever.
Oh, come on!
You say like a friend, no sex between us. I think you can find another girl to read the Da Vinci Code with you. Beck, stop. Tell me you want me.
I will walk out of this store and never look back, I swear to God, Joe.
Beck, stop. But you don't stop.
Joe, listen to me. I swear to you, I will disappear and it will be like I don't even exist anymore. Let me go and I promise that you will never, ever see me again. I swear. Joe?
You failed, and you do not get a gold star, and I squeeze your neck to make the wrong answers go away. They fester in your bulging eyes, and they turn your cheeks Nantucket red, and I squeeze harder. The wrong answers must be choked out through the bubbles of saliva that ooze from the corners of your gnarled mouth. You are a fucking idiot for thinking I want you out of my life. After all I've done for you, and this is not Reality Bites, and you don't want me over the other douchebags in your life, and I was wrong about you. You gasp.
Joe!
I will not be fooled. No, Beck!
You whisper. Help!
And I am helping, because you need an exorcism, a rebirth. You have sinned, and you did manipulate Nikki, and you did lead Peach on, and you did stalk Benji. You are a monster, deathly, solipsistic to the bone, and you're blasphemous because all you want is you. I squeeze too hard. You've gone quiet. I let go. Beck, I say. I want to hear your voice. I call again. Beck. Beck. Nothing comes from you, and fuck, what have I done? I shake your body, and I can't hear you breathing, and I need to hear you breathing, because Reality Bites is a stupid movie, and you did push Peach away, and Benji did lead you on, and Nikki did break the rules. So you said some stupid things. I do too sometimes, and I forgive you. I slide you off of my lap and onto the floor. You are so still, and all the good in you is in you, beneath those eyelids, latent. I love you for being so lovable. I am sorry, Beck. I can't hold you responsible for the fact that people go crazy over you. And you have to wake up because I want to give you love, 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 crazy love. I push my hands into your tiny chest. You are breathing, I think. You must be breathing. There cannot be nothing inside of someone as lovely and lit as you. We had an everything ship. You are too robust and full of life and bathrobe rules and orgasms and pies and bitter caramel apples to be gone. I hate myself, and I love you, and I kiss you, and you don't kiss me back, and I beg you to come back, and I hold your little hands, and I look into your little eyes, and at the end of the play Closer, upon which the movie is based, the Natalie Portman character gets hit by a car. She dies. In the movie, you don't see Natalie Portman die, and I like it better that way,
And you cannot be dead, Beck. You're not even 25, and you don't do drugs, and you are safe and sweet and studious, and I lean over you so that my ear touches your lips. When you breathe, I want to hear it and taste it, and I wait. I wait for 16 centuries and 8 light years, and I pull away. You are gone. I stand up and grab my hair, and I want to pull it out because you can't run your fingers through it anymore, and maybe I am wrong, and I get back down on the ground and mash my head into your hand and wait for you to touch me. Please, Vec, please. But your fingers don't move. And when I lift my head up, the silence feels official. It's hateful and personal, unlike the peaceful silence of the basement. You don't rise up to forgive me and ward off the evil silence that weighs me down more every second that you are mute. I look at you. You don't look at me. Your body is just parts now. You can't help me because you left me because you wanted to be gone forever. Your crimes are many, and you stole my love story, and I pick up your Da Vinci Code. I am stunned because some of the pages have never been turned. I know my way around a book. I think you skipped entire passages, you brainless phony. When you asked me where I was in the book, you were cheating. The most romantic time of my life was a hoax, and I am so preoccupied with exploring your Da Vinci Code that I don't see you come back to life. But you do. You tricked me, you cunt. You latch onto my ankle and pull, and I fall over and I drop your Da Vinci Code and land on my side, and it hurts, goddammit, and you kick me in the dick, and that hurts, goddammit. You are not gone forever, and you are possessed and out of words, and my groin aches, and my side pounds, and you are not my savior. You make things worse. You are alive, underhanded, kicking me when I'm down, and I scream in agony, and you are toxic and satanic because just a minute ago, you were dead, you fucking bitch. You say nothing. You kick. But I'm non-toxic, and I'm bigger and braver, and God gives me the strength to recover from your nasty blows. I swat your legs, and now you collapse, flat on your back. I mount you. You try to bite me, but you can't, and you try to kick me, but you can't, and you try to claw me, but your wrists are locked in my hands. You can't do anything with me pinning you down. You spit in my face. You are a mass hole, and you are weaker now, and I let go of your arms and wrap my hands around your neck for real this time. You try to hit me, but your little fists aren't what they once were. The bad in you outweighs the good, and your cheeks turn white, and my cock throbs in pain, and my hip bone pulsates, and your eyes bulge. You're disgusting. My mother's Nirvana t-shirt that I was wearing the day you stalked me to my house, the one I've held on to my whole life, it's a mess of cum and vanilla. You have torn it beyond repair, you bitch. You were right, Beck, I say to you. You kill people. You do. I squeeze your neck, and I thank you for kicking me in the dick, and I try to blink your saliva out of my eyelashes. I thank you for proving beyond a reasonable doubt that you are bad. You do not want love or life, and we never had a chance, and you are commonplace and raw, gasping and gurgling, solipsistic with your fudgy, inconsiderate fingerprints ruining my books, my heart, my life. What's that, Beck? You have one word left in you. Help. And I do help you. I take my right hand and reach for your Da Vinci Code. I shove the book into my mouth and bite a few pages. I yank the book away, and I toss it and grab the torn pages out of my mouth, wet with saliva that you wanted so badly. My last words to you. Open up, Guinevere. I shove the pages into your mouth, and your pupils slip around and your back arches. This is the sound of you dying. There are bones cracking, where, I do not know, and tear ducts in emergency mode. The tear of death seeps out of your left eye and onto your porcelain cheek, and your eyes are fixated on somewhere I have never traveled, gladly beyond any experience. Your eyes have their silence. You are no better than a doll now, and you do not react as the pages in your mouth take the blood that rises from your gullet. And all at once I miss you, and you missed me. And I call to you, and I seize your tiny shoulders. You do not respond. You are as flawed as all the books in the store. You have ended and left me, and you are gone. Forever. You will never leave me in the dark ever again, and I will never wait for a response from you ever again. Your light is out for good now, and I take you in my arms. No. I want to throw myself in front of engine number 9. How could I have done this? I never made you pancakes. What the fuck is wrong with me? I can't breathe, and you are my sweet lord, Beck. Different. Hot. You are. Were. I cry.
Chapter 52. At the end of your days, you claimed that you weren't a writer. But I think you would appreciate the poetic symmetry regarding your burial. It was a long, lonely drive upstate, more than 4 hours outside of the city. It was tough going in the Buick, with you in the trunk, with your green pillow, silent as Little Compton in the winter. I drove past Nicky's Pizza, and I kept going, and I found this diner. Nicky's and his brother's extra homes are nestled in nearby Forest Lake, a private area just outside of Chestertown. This is a pure township, Beck, old-fashioned and pleasantly anchored to an antiquated way of life. I eat a grilled cheese sandwich because I have to, because burying you in the cold forest will be demanding, even though everyone who comes into the diner can't resist remarking on the mild winter. So mild, I wouldn't need a red Holden Caulfield hunting cap from Macy's even if I still had one. I will not cry. Not here. Most in the diner are local, and those who aren't local have driven in for a car show. The waitress asks me if I'm here for the car show, and I say that I am, and I check my phone, and I have to go to the bathroom again because every time I check my phone, it's like you die all over again. Nobody, not even the rain, has such small hands. And I cry, quietly, so as not to attract attention. Your death is a song on repeat, and I splash cold water on my face and try not to think about the fact that I will never hear from you ever again. I won't, Beck. You are dead. I know that Nicky is not stupid. He wouldn't bury you on his own property. But he would drive into the nearby woods off Forest Lake Drive, as I do now an hour after sunset. I see a pink and white sign. There is an event. Chet and Rose's wedding is happening tonight at the camp at the end of the road, but I will not be deterred. I veer off-road into the blackness that's purer than the beaches of LC and darker than the depths of your solipsistic soul. There is no ocean here to soften the starless blow of eternity. I break, slowly. Chet and Rose are the ones with bad timing, not me, dammit. The night is so empty that I can hear the wedding when I shut off the Buick. I strap on my night vision goggles and grab my shovel and step out into the darkness. I try not to listen to the wedding as I shovel, but it's hard. Chet and Rose take their first dance, Clapton's Wonderful Tonight, as their friends and family clap. I wonder what our wedding song would have been. And I ask you, but you don't answer. You were dead. I dig. I have never been and will never be as alone as I am while I dig. Upstate New York clings to the cold like no other place. Only here would I have to listen to Eric Clapton shut off lights and praise his loyal, beautiful girlfriend as I, alone, sweat and shiver and prepare to put you into the dirt. Life goes on, so literally, and I stab my shovel in the bitter earth. I bend over to catch my breath. I look over at you, wrapped up in a woolly blanket from Bed Bath & Beyond, silenced in the open trunk. I am breathing normally now, and the revelers are doing the electric slide. And would we have had a wedding like this? I suppose it would have been on Nantucket, because you're the one with a family. I would have invited Ethan and Blythe and Mr. Mooney. Mr. Mooney wouldn't have come. But he would have transferred the title of the shop to you and me, I know it. I want the wedding to stop, and I would like to scream at the top of my lungs, but I don't want to alarm you. But I can't alarm you. You are dead. I dig, and the party goes on. There are toasts and cheers, and Stevie Wonder sings about his precious daughter. Isn't she lovely, made from love? And we'll never have a daughter, and I lose my temper and throw my shovel. I crawl into the earth and let the music beat the living fuck out of me. I can't fight it anymore. And joy at the far end of the woods has become monotonous. I'm not one of those people who ever thought get lucky was so fucking special. I can almost taste their vodka. And I am the uninvited guest, out of sight, alone. What soothes me, what allows me to keep digging, is the likelihood that Chet and Rose have a website, a registry. Knowing that I will be able to find them, to see them, is a comfort somehow. Neil Young sings for Chet and Rose. Harvest Moon, that hurts. And Neil Young will never play for you and me on our wedding day, and you don't hear him now. You are dead. I lift your body out of the trunk and unravel the area rug that encapsulates you. You are still beautiful, and I rest my head on your chest and tell you about Chet and Rose. I will probably die alone, under an insignificant moon, and you won't be there to mourn. You soar on to heaven, and I have to summon the strength to set your precious corpse in the ground. Chet and Rose are surrounded by friends and family, but I alone lift your petite body and maketh you to lie down in green pastures. It would be nice to have a moment of silence. Chet and Rose are rude to be so loud. But I can't blame them. They can't see me, can't hear me. They're in their own world, where good things happen, a quarter mile and a million light years away. I kneel on the ground and recite the 23rd Psalm. I memorized it for this occasion. You are dead. There's no way to know what happens to us after the wedding we won't have, after life. I walk in the woods and look at the world with inhuman night vision and see all that man was not built to see. I don't know if you will dwell in the house of the Lord forever, but I lie on my back and listen to the party for Chet and Rose grow as quiet as the night, as death. They will get tired, and their party will end, and if anyone was ever going to live eternally in the light, I think it would be you. I cover you with dirt and rocks and branches and leaves, and you are so much more than a body. The walk back to my car is a short one. The drive away from Chet and Rose and your body is a long one in the dark of night. I don't know that I'll ever make it home, and even when I do make it into my apartment, I remain unsure of whether or not I will ever have a true home. I will never have you. You are buried by Forest Lake, near Chet and Rose, somewhere I have never traveled gladly beyond any experience. I don't open the shop the next day. I can't. You are dead. Chapter 53. The mail I typically receive is boring and financial, bills, coupons, crap. But today, almost 3 months after your passing, I received the first wedding invitation of my life via the United States Postal Service. The envelope is so big the postman had to walk it upstairs and lean it against my door. I know I'm not an expert, but it's a beauty, Beck, and I have it with me here at the shop. I'm enamored with the triumphant romance of the thick, embossed cardstock juxtaposed with the delicate gold italicized cursive. Who knew Ethan and Blythe were royalty? A lot happens in 3 months. Exclamation point Ethan and Blythe have gotten engaged and invited me to their wedding in Austin, Texas. A lot doesn't happen in 3 months. The help wanted sign is still in the window. Ethan got a corporate job. Marriage is expensive. But this invitation has altered my perspective. I haven't felt this hopeful since exiting Dr. Nikki's office, since entering you. The future exists again because of this invitation. This invitation necessitates that I mark dates on my calendar, and it feels good to flip ahead through the calendar in my phone. Before this invitation arrived, addressed to Mr. Joe Goldberg and guest, I was only flipping through months gone by, inventing anniversaries for our life that's gone. You above all others know the importance of moving on. You like new things. You liked new things. Life is not a Dan Brown book. You are dead and you are not coming back. But life is better than a Dan Brown book because at long last, I have something to look forward to. A wedding. I have to decide between steak and fish, and I am genuinely torn about the decision. And I have to make this decision within the next 41 days according to the rules on the reply card. The bell chimes on this slow day that's neither summer nor fall. An unremarkable man in shorts asks about Dr. Sleep. I point him to fiction G through K, and I think of the time I saw you in fiction F through K, and what a fool I was in the days after. I've rearranged the shop. I couldn't look at F through K anymore. I genuinely believed that reshaping the shelves would make it easier to live in the world without you. The world I built with my own two hands. The world that won't allow me to tell you that I know you stole your Ritz robes from Peach. I still get flashbacks. I still cringe. I am eating again, but only because I hate fainting. Everything has been an exercise until now. I will always feel indebted to the United States Postal Service, to Ethan, to Blythe. And I will never again underestimate the power of anticipation. There is no better boost in the present than an invitation to the future. The loner buys the king and leaves with the king, and I am going to need to buy a suit. It's wonderful to have a project, and I celebrate by visiting Chet and Rose's online love nest. I feel like I've gotten to know them so well since that dreadful night in the woods. I want to tell them about the invitation. I've become obsessed with Chet and Rose, but how could I not?
They gathered in the woods to be married so that I could still believe in love. I love them. I've watched their honeymoon slideshow hundreds of times. They were there for me. What timing. I used to play the slideshow and pretend that we're the ones on a honeymoon in Cabo San Lucas. But these days, I'm less bitter. I know that we all don't get to be Chet and Rose. It is an indisputable fact. Some people on this earth receive love, get married, and honeymoon in Cabo. Others do not. Some people read alone on the sofa, and some people read together in bed. That's life. I will probably die alone. Karen Minty will probably die married. Lots of people love the King of Queens. And I am fine with my fate. It was my decision to spare you the pain of life. I let go of you. I forgive you. It's not your fault that you carried your demons awkwardly in that big Prada bag, in those giant used robes from Peach's Ritz. You were toxic, not vicious, and the men who did leave you are thriving. That Hesher guy has a television show that doesn't suck. An online registry at Babies R Us shows that your father is about to become a father again. Some people get it all, they do. I think you would be happy to know that your voice carries. I am the sole reader of the Book of Beck. I had your short stories bound at FedEx, but millions of people have devoured the story of your life. Everyone knows about the twisted psychologist who murdered you. You never were published in the New Yorker, but you did make the New York Post. You changed me, Beck. I will not grow lonely like Mr. Mooney. I have Ethan and Blythe. I have the girls they periodically foist upon me. The girls are always terrible, wan and patronizing or shallow and simple. I am like Hugh Grant in Love Actually, minus the love, which isn't so bad when you realize that in real life, Hugh Grant is single, like me. Once again, not all animals are destined to pair off. Yes, I understand that we are built for companionship. God gave us vocabularies. We need to speak. We need to listen. I fuck occasionally, girls from the internet, girls from the shop, but mostly I keep to myself. No longer do I open petal by petal, and you were right, Beck. You were not the girl I thought you were, and Barbara Hershey wasn't the one for Elliot and Hannah and her sisters. The doorbell chimes, and I look up from a photo of Chet and Rose on paddleboards and see a girl. A girl I know, sort of. She wears a University of Pittsburgh tank top and jeans. She squirms, she waves. I wish there was music playing right now. She liked my music last time. I saw the sign in the window, she swallows. Are you still hiring? Sometimes they forget to take down the sign. Sometimes it's bullshit. I'm sorry. I'm swearing. I forgot about the sign, but I did not forget about Amy Adam and her stolen credit card and her fraudulent academic attire and her large chestnut eyes. We are still hiring. She comes over. She glances at my wedding invitation and nods. I love Austin. So, how have you been? I ask, and it's a silken maneuver on my part. I am the gentleman assuming the role of the one who remembers so that she may be the lady remembered. She fawns, almost curtsies. She is flattered and happy. She is staring at me, and it feels good in her eyes, and she hands me a resume. I used to work at a little bookstore in Williamsburg, but let's just say it didn't work out because of their short-sighted policies about what they call stealing. She grunts. Like I shouldn't bring books home and read them? And exactly how do you even read a book without marking it up? She is loud. Excuse me if I'm not one of those ultra-modern Kindle people, but I like pens, paper, real pages I can rip and touch. She shakes her head. And if you bought a book and found notes in the margins, I mean, who wouldn't love that? It's a bonus. She doesn't want me to answer. She blinks. I'm sorry, I'm going off, but it has to be said. She needs my acceptance. I smile. No apology necessary. Now it's her turn and she complies, playful. I probably sound like a lunatic. Do you guys hire lunatics? I tell her that we only hire lunatics, and she thinks I am funny. She has a lilting laugh and she likes it here with me. She will be my cashier and my girlfriend, and the next time I'm invited to a wedding, it will be addressed to Joe Goldberg and Amy Adam. And I won't have to worry about finding a guest. You are gone forever. And she is here now.
You was written by Caroline Kepnes and read by Santino Fontana. It was recorded by Bob Barito. Editing and post-production by Common Mode, Paul Fowley, technical director. The mix engineer was Terry Hogan. The associate producers were Madeline Mabey and Jennifer Lopes. You was produced and directed by Ben Rimmelauer. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.